reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Seated. We're seeing our third case for today and last for the March argument, 05AP002MM, Kenosha County Department of Human Services versus Jody W. Representing Jody W. is Joseph W. Voiland. Counsel, you may proceed.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, I am Joe Voiland, and along with my colleague Mr. Balin and an attorney in our Madison office, Becky Fryhart, we represent the petitioner Jody W. Jody is not here today, but happily she is no longer incarcerated. I want to start and ask if I could reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Can I do that now?
It is already reserved, counsel.
It's always good to be in Madison, to be back in Madison. I was reminded of my time here. I was driving down Washington Avenue this morning, and there was a gentleman riding his bike down the road in a big orange jumpsuit playing the piccolo. And I remembered that he
knew it was Madison.
Things haven't changed if you're observing that.
Yes. I used to go to Fife's Corner Bistro every Friday night, and he plays in a band called Piccolissimo, and watch him play. And if you've never seen that, that's fabulous. So go to Fife's Corner Bistro on Friday nights. But that was the first thought that I had today. That was not about what I want to talk to the court about today, which is this. I think there was a little bit of confusion in the argument that we're making, so I want to make it clear. We are not arguing that a parent of a child in need of protection or services who is incarcerated cannot have their parental rights terminated. We are arguing that the circuit court can and the circuit court should consider a parent's incarceration in determining whether a parent of a child in need of protection or services has failed to meet the conditions established for the return of the child to the home in the termination of parental rights proceeding.
Are you saying that the circuit judge did not consider that in this case?
I don't think the circuit judge considered that until she got to the disposition phase. The circuit judge considered that the parent was incarcerated and that therefore she couldn't meet the condition of return within 12 months. So certainly, yes, Justice Wilcox, she did consider that.
Well, she knew, if I'm just looking at the record, it would make a difference as far as, from what I saw on the record, how long the person was going to be incarcerated. You may not have had the same answer. Are you saying you'd have the same result here regardless of how long the person had been incarcerated or was to be incarcerated?
No.
Say it was only 5 months. Do you think the judge's decision would have been or could have been different?
If the incarceration was only 5 months, I think the judge...
5 months longer, right.
Or, was it only 5 months in total?
Or in other words, when the judge decided this, as I understand it, Kenosha judge, she looked at the fact, and it was presented by your opposing counsel, that this person had been and was incarcerated, that this was her fourth OWI, if I may be mistaken, for not only eluding, but there were some forgery charges that she looked at. What you're saying is the judge didn't look at this. I kind of thought that the judge did.
I think the circuit judge did, but she looked at all of those factors at the disposition phase. At the grounds phase, the circuit judge certainly did consider the fact that the parent was incarcerated, and if the parent would be incarcerated for longer than 12 months and therefore would not meet the condition of return, But that was the only factor that the circuit judge considered in determining the parent's fitness under the statute.
Counsel, I want to take you back to your opening statements. You started with a, we are not arguing this, and then you said, we are arguing that the circuit court can and should consider incarceration in a TPR proceeding. That sounded to me like you were doing a little outlining there. Is there another outline that you want to give us before we proceed, or have you finished?
I have something next, sure.
Okay, I can hardly wait.
And I'll take the chance. But the circuit court's consideration of the parent's incarceration should come alongside, and here I'll quote from 48.4152A, quote, the characteristics of the parent, the level of cooperation of the parent, and the other relevant circumstances of the case. The circuit court's consideration of the parent's incarceration should not be in isolation. The circuit court's consideration should not be in isolation because if it is, and if the parent is going to be incarcerated for longer than a period of 12 months, that argument creates a mandatory, conclusive presumption that the parent will be incarcerated for that long is not fit to be a parent. And that will be true whether the parent's incarcerated, whether the parent's sent to prison, or whether the parent's sent to Iraq. If the parent is gone for that length of time, that type of rule creates an irrebuttable presumption that that parent is not fit.
When did the condition that you that had to be complied with that as a suitable residence, when was that imposed? What date? Well, here's what I'm driving at. Was it imposed when it was already known that she was going to be in prison for 12 months or longer than 12 months?
Yes, it was imposed as part of the CHIPS order.
And the CHIPS order, at the time of the CHIPS order, it was known that she was going to be incarcerated for a period extending 12 months.
We don't have the CHIPS file. The CHIPS file, the CHIPS case is a separate case and is not part of the record, so I can't answer that with certainty. I believe so. I don't know whether she had appellate rights still or any other circumstances.
It seemed to me that you should be, you might be arguing that where the court imposes a condition, namely a suitable residence within 12 months, and the court knows that this person is going to be incarcerated. And even if there are appeal rights, most of the time you don't stay a sentence. Sentence goes on. Sometimes you do. Where the court knows that that person is going to be incarcerated for that time period, and therefore, by definition, cannot provide a suitable residence, that's setting this person up for failure, is setting that person up for a ground for termination, and that's not fair. That's basically not the goal of the condition. The condition is to do something that is needed for the child and within, or should be within, the means of the party.
I will not disagree with you.
Well, I didn't expect you to disagree with me. I want to know why that's not absolutely right as a matter of due process. And why isn't that your argument?
Why isn't my argument that is wrong as a matter of due process?
Yeah. That she is set up to fail, and you can't take away a child from a parent by setting them up to fail.
I will maybe take a step back and explain why the due process violation is not my argument. And the simplest sentence I can say it in is, out of great respect for the legislature, I don't believe that the legislature intended a parent's failure to meet an impossible condition of return by itself to be a grounds of parental unfitness.
And so, if they had intended that, then it would be a violation of due process. But you can't imagine that they would have intended that.
I have to presume that the legislature would not have done that. And that is why I don't lead with the due process argument. I want to lead, my brief leads with the statutory argument.
Counselor, in a CHIPS proceeding, the county has the burden of showing they've done a reasonably good job of trying to reunite the parent and the child and in assisting the parent in meeting the conditions. If this condition was set up in the CHIPS order and it was never possible to meet it, how can the county meet its burden of showing they've assisted the parent in meeting the condition?
I think we had they can't. I don't think the county can. I don't think the county can show by a sufficiency of the evidence that they've provided those types of things. And we had a little fun with that in brief. I think the county's position is that in the position of the amicus is that the county's reasonable efforts need to be viewed from the light of was it possible for the county to meet those conditions? And I don't think it's fair for the county to argue that the reasonable efforts they made or the services they provided were simply impossible to provide. And the county's excused from that failure, but the parent at the same time is not.
I have a question. And this comes out of the opposing counsel's brief. If we were to accept your argument and if you were to prevail, what impact is this going to have? In other words, we have people that are incarcerated for 2 years, 10 years, 20 years, and how does that go against the thrust of the preamble of the statute, which talks about the best interest of the children? We're talking about here setting up a special situation for people who may be incarcerated for 1, 2, 3, 10 years. How do you address that?
I would address it this way, and that is why I wanted to start the argument by saying that we are not arguing that a parent who is incarcerated cannot have their rights terminated. If a parent is incarcerated 20 years or 50 years of their life, I think the circuit court's determination of parental fitness or unfitness is a much easier call than it is in this type of a case where the parent was incarcerated. It was 5 months past the 12. It's 17 months. So the circuit...
And I just want to interject, excuse me for interrupting. Actually, as I understand it from the facts, that she had parented the child until he was 2. He's now 5 and a half. He's going to be 6 in July. So there was a 3-year gap while she was out of his life, as I understand it. Have I factually stated what is the fact here? Is that correct?
That is correct, but there was a delay in the county bringing the petition to terminate. So there was a longer period of time in the middle there than the 12-month time period, but the county did not bring the petition immediately upon the entry of the CHIPS order. It could have brought it after 6 months, I believe.
Counsel, you say there's nothing wrong with the statute. We ask, and you say you're not making the due process argument vis-a-vis the statute, but you are making a due process argument as applied here. In other words, as I understand your argument, statute might be fine. Legislature could not have intended this, but reading page 1 of your brief, as the statute was applied by the circuit court, it violated Jody's due process rights by allowing a finding of unfitness based on nothing more than the passage of time. So I guess I want to get back to, are you making a due process as applied here?
If the statute does not mean what it says that we mean, I'm sorry, back up. If the statute is not construed as we propose the statute should be construed, then yes, we are.
And you're proposing to construe it as follows, colon.
I am proposing to construe the statute in a manner that complies with due process, that requires the circuit court to make an individualized determination of parental fitness or unfitness in each case, as the court said in the Sheboygan County versus Julie A.B. case, the circuit judge is not an automaton.
Well, it makes an individualized determination. It says, look, she's going to be gone for 15 months. She can't provide a suitable home for this child. She's been convicted or at least up and has troubles with drug and alcohol addiction. Kids, too. She's going to be gone a year, year and a half or whatever. These are formative years. The child needs a stable home, has one, we terminate. That good enough?
I think a number of the factors you just listed might belong in the disposition phase. I think there's a concurrence in the Stephen v. Kelly H. case about the danger of conflating the factors that belong in the disposition phase with the grounds phase. And at the grounds phase...
The grounds phase are that she's addicted and that she's incarcerated for a long period. Is it good enough?
No. I think it is up to the circuit judge to determine how long, how addicted she is. And the circuit judge, and here's where I go back to the statute, can only do that if it looks at the characteristics of the parent, the level of the cooperation of the parent, and the other relevant circumstances of the case. And that's the language of the statute in evaluating the reasonable efforts of the department. And I think the circuit judge can do that and make an individualized determination in each case rather than a one-size-fits-all, 12 months, you're terminated.
But didn't the circuit judge know the fact that she had drug and alcohol problems, fourth OWI conviction, forgery, eluding? The judge knew that that was before her. Are you saying that that was not taken? That was my initial question, that was not taken into consideration?
That I think that brings me into to the plea argument, but at the grounds phase, I don't believe the circuit judge took that into consideration. The circuit judge took that into consideration at disposition. And I want to answer one more question of yours, Justice Wilcox, which I did not get to the last time you asked the question. And that was, how should we look at the best interest of the child when we're looking at parental unfitness? And I'll go back to the Julie A.B. case, and the court's begins with a statute that you recited, Wisconsin Statute 48.01, sub 1, provides in part, the best interest of the child shall always be of paramount consideration, period. That's the statute. And the court says in the very next paragraph, notwithstanding this broad language, the best interest of the child standard does not dominate every step of every proceeding, because other vital interests must be accommodated. When the government seeks to terminate parental rights, the best interest of the child standard does not prevail until the affected parent has been found unfit.
Okay. Mr. Roiland, this is under 48.415.2A3, is that right?
I want to be sure I have the right subsection. 48.415.2A3, that's right.
Okay, and that is a grounds for unfitness.
I don't want to disagree with you, but I want to say that 48.415 sub 2 is a grounds for unfitness.
Well, it's under the heading grounds for involuntary termination of parental rights, and a whole series of grounds. One of them is 2.
Sub 2, yes, sir.
All right. Now, the legislature has said here, as I understand it, first we have to have a child who's in need of protection or services. And you can't have a grounds under sub 2 without a CHIPS finding. Isn't that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And secondly, the child is outside the home.
That's right.
All right. And third, this particular parent has been out of the picture for 6 months. And into the future, we don't see that parent involved for another 12 months. Is that right?
I wouldn't use the word involved, but the parent will not be able to herself provide for the child within those 12 months, yes.
Okay. Now, why isn't that a perfectly rational grounds? It may not be a grounds, or it may not be the total answer in the end, in the disposition phase, but why isn't that a rational grounds? Not in the home, child in need of protection and services, and we really got 18 months here of parental absence. What's wrong with that?
I don't want to claim that is not a rational grounds, and that's why I wouldn't start with a challenge to the constitutionality of the statute. That in many cases can be irrational grounds, and it is. As applied in this case, it doesn't, if the statute is read so that simply that 6 months, child outside the home, 6 months, 12 months, total of 18 months, equates to parental unfitness, it doesn't allow for an individualized determination whether that particular parent is unfit to be a parent of that child. And it doesn't.
But the legislature has determined what is unfit. If certain things are fall within the facts, if certain facts fall within the standards of the statute, that is unfitness. That doesn't mean there's termination, but there are grounds for unfitness. Isn't that correct?
You were in the legislature and I was not.
So you're an advantage to say the legislature can't do everything.
But I want to say that, yes, that is the statutory grounds set by the Wisconsin legislature for unfitness. There are other aspects of the statute which I think read together mean that that itself is not grounds for unfitness. And
Mr. Boylan, I want you to answer Justice Prosser's question. But you just threw me for a loop. As I read the statute, it says that a finding that grounds exist for termination of parental rights. I don't see that statute as saying that that's a ground, statutory grounds for, quote, unfitness. Aren't they two separate things?
No.
Oh, we see what happens if they should hear us when we say anything else.
We've had this argument before. Well,
I will stay with Justice Prosser's answer to your question and say no.
Why are you meddling?
But let me say this, Justice Prosser, and I am trying to get back to your question and trying to remember what it was. But yes, those are, I mean that in no bad way, that is a grounds. But I think that the statute allows the circuit court judge to make a determination that there could be a defense to those grounds, that there can be an explanation why the parent cannot meet those grounds, and to construe a statute to say that that alone means that a parent is unfit goes too far. And let me tell you a case, this court's decision in the Stephen versus Kelly H case, and why I think that is not how this court would read that statute. When the court and Steve V talked about which of these particular grounds under the statute are amenable to summary judgment, and were amenable to summary judgment because they could be proven simply by reference to documentary evidence, the court did not list 48.415 sub 2 as one of those grounds under the statute, grounds of unfitness, that is amenable to proof by simple documentary evidence. If this court held, I'm sorry, were this court to hold that is all that it takes, that the 12 months passes after 6 months had initially passed, sub 2 would become another grounds for summary judgment in a termination of wrong rights case. And I think that the reason the court didn't do that, and I'll go to footnote 8 of the majority opinion in that case, is that the court says, in some circumstances, the applicable statutory basis for unfitness indeed may provide a defense, or may allow the parent to provide an explanation of why she has not satisfied the listed grounds of the legislature in the statute. And the court was addressing in that footnote the concerns of the concurrence and of the dissent that in certain circumstances the parent needs to be able to provide an explanation of why his or her conduct does not constitute unfitness by means of a constitutional challenge.
Does it complicate the situation because there was a plea here of no contest? What do you do with that?
Throw it out.
Well, sure. Well, you throw it out. Why? Because she didn't understand it? It seems to me that Judge Wagner went through a very lengthy colloquy, throw it out because you feel it's unjust or because what reason?
Sure. I said that in jest. I think that the plea is defective. And to answer your first question, Justice Wilcox, yes, it does complicate things. And that's been on my mind. The plea is not, the plea in this case was not knowing, and I'm going to, I'm at page 88 of our appendix, in our opening brief, and I'll wait until you're there with me. And while you're looking for that, I lead into that with Julie Avery, which I read from earlier, and the importance of not conflating the grounds phase with the disposition phase. And I think that in the plea colloquy, the grounds phase and the disposition phase were merged together, and that the parent did not understand that by pleading to the grounds, the entire focus of the proceeding was going to shift into disposition, and that the entire view of the court shifted from the parent's fundamental rights into the best interest of the child. And I will go through the plea colloquy. This is at 88 of the appendix on the bottom, starting at 921. The court says, "You understand the reason you came to court today?" Jody says, "Yes." The court said, "And you understand that you're waiving your right to a trial and then proceeding to phase two of the disposition?" And Jody says, "Yes." Nothing in that colloquy gives any indication that the parent understands the difficulties. Nothing in that colloquy gives any indication that the parent understood the difficulties that she was going to face by pleading no contest to the grounds portion. And again, this happens at page 20. I'm sorry, it's 20 in the transcript. It's appendix 90. The court says at the bottom, "Okay, and so you understand by entering this no contest plea to the grounds portion that you're still able to argue and present evidence in the dispositional portion, correct?" And Jody says, "Yes." And then immediately Jody does on the next page admit that she says that there are grounds to terminate her parental rights. I have to admit that. But in the colloquy, the individual colloquy between the court and the parent, nothing gave her any understanding, nothing in the record shows any understanding that she understood what she was giving up by pleading no contest at the grounds phase. That she was giving up a portion of the trial that would have been focused on her and on her fundamental rights and shifting over into a phase two, as the court calls it, which is correct, but to the parent, I don't think that meant anything. It just meant we're going on to the disposition phase. And the disposition phase is so different. The focus of the court's inquiry at the disposition phase and of the parent's rights at the disposition phase is so different. There's no indication the parent understood that in this colloquy.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mary M. Hart, Assistant District Attorney, Kenosha, representing the Kenosha County Department of Human Services. Ms. Hart.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. To my left is Attorney John Mason, the guardian ad litem for Max W. At the time Max came into the juvenile court system, he was approximately 2 years old. And during his life, he endured the fourth operating while intoxicated offense by his mother, possession of drug paraphernalia by his mother.
How did he endure those?
He endured them in the sense that his mother was taken from him through her arrest and ultimate conviction thereof. And so to the extent that Max W. had to live through a life that was not a sufficient life, which would go to his best interest, would go to ensuring his safety and stability in a home,
Was she taken out, I mean, was she incarcerated prior to conviction for any of these offenses, or are you just using that phrase to imply what happened after conviction?
No, she was incarcerated, actually. And in the mother's own testimony, she indicated that she was incarcerated at Tuchia for a period of 6 months, even before the Department of Social Services got involved. And so for 6 months prior to the department getting involved, at least for that period of time, he wasn't even living with her.
I'm sorry, I'm probably not being very clear. What I'm trying to understand is, did her incarceration by the state of Wisconsin begin after conviction, or was she incarcerated for periods of time, either locally or some other way, prior to conviction while Max was alive?
Yes, she was incarcerated.
Okay.
She committed and operating while intoxicated and was taken into custody during that period of time. And she remained in custody primarily as a result of a couple of issues. Not only the fleeing issue, she was held in custody and ultimately convicted of that. She was held on a probation and parole hold as a result of her forgery, probation, and subsequent revocation. And so to the extent, in trying to answer your question, she was incarcerated even before Max came to the attention of the juvenile court. He was residing with his grandparents, and at some point his grandparents determined that they were no longer able to be a resource for Max, and she had been sentenced on the fleeing issue to a lengthy period of incarceration in the Wisconsin prison
system. When the CHIPS petition was filed, she was already incarcerated.
She was, and Max was adjudicated to be in need of protection and services.
Because the mother was incarcerated. Because the mother was incarcerated and no one else was taking care of him.
He was adjudicated based on two CHIP statutes. One was the incarceration statute under 4813 sub 8. And he was adjudicated to be in need of protection and services under 4813 sub 10,
right,
in that his parent had neglected, refused, or been unable for reasons other than poverty to provide necessary care, food, clothing, medical or dental care, shelter, so as to seriously endanger his physical health.
That was because she was in prison.
There is not sufficient information in the record to answer your question.
Okay.
The CHIPS petition is not before this court.
Okay. But she was incarcerated, and one of the conditions of return was that she provide a suitable home within 12 months.
That was a condition of return that was entered, and that makes sense for any child, that a child be returned to a home that is safe for that child to return to. At the time that this child was detained,
does the mother have to be in the home? I mean, suppose we are not dealing with a mother who's impoverished. Suppose we're dealing with a white-collar criminal who is incarcerated, removed immediately, incarcerated, don't put up bail because might flee, and doesn't have any arrangements made for the child. So there's no grandparents, no family. There's the child. So immediately the department comes in, right, and wants to help the child, right, because the mother, no father, father dead, mother is incarcerated, right? Okay.
Yes.
And mother pleads, and you have a fast conviction and sentencing to 5 years. Got a 2-year-old child, 5 years. Mother can't get a home for the child in 12 months, but the mother has money. Can the mother put up money and send the kid to a boarding school? Hire somebody to buy a house and put the child in it? Is that going to be good enough?
Potentially, the mother could send the child to boarding school with the permission of the juvenile court, or certainly relatives would be...
I'm making it simple. No relatives. Looking at, like, this child is alone. There are no relatives willing to take care of it.
The only difference in my two fact situations is the mother has money and can provide facilities for this child, whether it's a boarding school or buying a house and having full-time, three or four full-time people doing nothing but helping this child.
The child would still be in a non-relative home, and that's contrary to the children's code.
So you'd terminate this mother's parental rights?
Not necessarily. I mean, certainly the fact that a child is found to be in need of protection and services is just but one element that the court has to consider in terms of whether or not to terminate parental rights.
But there'd be grounds for termination.
After a period of time, there potentially could be grounds to terminate parental rights. The continuing CHIPS ground requires certain things, including that the child be found to be in need of protection services, placed outside the home, that the court orders contain the termination of parental rights warnings, that social services has to make a reasonable effort to provide the services ordered by the court.
All the same as in this case. But in my case, the person has money.
I think what, at the time of the dispositional hearing, what the court would do would be to evaluate a number of factors. If we're talking about a parent who has committed a white-collar crime, is going to be out in 5 years, and the child is 15, the court, in its discretion in entering a dispositional order, could choose not to terminate parental rights due to the relationships between the parent and the child. The fact that, in your example, that the child is 2 years old and the parent has a 5-year sentence certainly moves that case more towards what I believe to be a leaning of the circuit court overall and consistent with the Adoptions and Safe Families Act and the legislative purpose to ensure that children do not languish in the foster care system unnecessarily. The example that you gave, however, suggests that the mother does not have other deficits. If she's committing a white-collar crime, I'm assuming from your example that the mother does not have drug and alcohol issues, does not have a history of instability in housing, does not have the issues of domestic violence. All of those issues are issues in this particular case, in Jody W.'s case, in the case which impacts Max W. Well,
now, the argument of opposing counsel is that the judge really never looked at those. And is that the case?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. At the time the plea was entered, and we have a plea colloquy and a plea questionnaire, there is no indication that the reason why Jody W. was entering her no-contest plea was simply because she did not have a residence and she was incarcerated. There is nothing in the record that says that that is her sole basis for doing that. In fact, the testimony of the social worker at the time that the court was considering grounds and receiving evidence in support of the termination of parental rights ground, meaning the continuing CHIPS ground, received the uncontroverted testimony of a social worker in this regard. The amended petition was incorporated into her testimony on grounds. The social worker testified that the parent had not demonstrated appropriate parenting skills, had not successfully completed counseling, and not successfully completed counseling specific to the issues of domestic violence, and that was a condition of return, had not even begun drug and alcohol treatment.
Well, wasn't that because she was incarcerated?
Right. I don't know whether or not she could complete domestic violence counseling or individual counseling or alcohol and drug treatment. That's not in the record. We don't have any information in the record to suggest that the reason she could not complete those conditions of return was because they were somehow not available. There's nothing in the record to suggest that.
So what about, I'm looking at the appendix in the blue brief on pages 25 and 28, that the termination of parental rights plea questionnaire and waiver of rights form. And this form that was signed by Jody W. has a number of line-outs and write-ins in the margins where she says that
she is contesting certain things, that there are, she disagrees that these alternatives are available due to the filing of the TPR petition, disagrees with this because of the petition, contests this matter, still disagrees that the alternatives are available with the filing of the petition, still contesting this position. Isn't she indicating over and over again that she's got a problem here with what's going on and she just can't meet the she's saying that the alternatives aren't even available.
I don't think so.
Well, that's what she wrote in the court.
In the plea colloquy with the court and in her completion of the plea questionnaire, 40W cites a concern regarding the plea questionnaire indicating along those lines that there were certain alternatives such as child support. Well, that simply wasn't possible. We did not have a legal father. So while that potentially could be an alternative available to get support for the child through a child support order, that was not an alternative that was available. Certainly in terms of the parenting classes, she did successfully complete a parenting class in the institution. Those were simply things that the court, through this plea questionnaire and through the colloquy, acknowledged to Jody W. that those alternatives, food stamps, for example, don't apply to a person who's incarcerated. While they may be available to someone who's not incarcerated, the fact of the matter is you can't get child support if you don't have an adjudicated father. You can't get food stamps or Title 19 if you are an incarcerated person. In terms of the placement with relatives, it didn't apply in this particular case because social services looked into other possible relatives, and there were no other relatives. And so while technically those alternatives may exist, they didn't exist in this particular case because of the mother's incarceration. Her incarceration, which, by the way, she created. This is not a situation in which she was awaiting trial, presumed innocent. She was guilty of fleeing. The separation between herself and her child was caused by her own actions. And now she is seeking for Max to wait.
Counsel, when you say she's seeking to have Max wait, this gets me back to my concern in this case, and I need you to help me see this more clearly. My concern is that she was found to be unfit, essentially because of the passage of time that she would be incarcerated for, and ergo unavailable. And if that's the only ground, then I think there are problems. I don't mean ground, I have to be careful with my words. If that's the only circumstance, then I think there might be a problem.
The passage of time alone did not cause the termination of her parental rights.
Let me take a look at the statute that we're dealing with, which is, as I understand it, 48415-2A3, and I want to go through this with you. The child has been outside the home for a cumulative total period of 6 months or longer, pursuant to a order, CHIP's order, not including time spent outside the home as an unborn child. Okay, so she fits in that, is that correct? At the time of the termination of parental rights, she had been outside the home six months. Okay. And that the parent has failed to meet the conditions established for the safe return of the child to the home. And what conditions were alleged to have been failed to have been met?
She did not complete drug and alcohol treatment. She did not complete individual counseling. She was ordered to participate in domestic violence-specific counseling, and she did not complete that. She did not obtain and maintain a suitable residence and did not pay child support. She did not demonstrate an ability to appropriately parent her child.
The ability to provide suitable housing may have been compromised because of her incarceration.
It was compromised when she decided to commit a crime and ultimately be held accountable for that crime. The needs of a child, any child, are the same. Are the same.
I think here I am. You know, I'm a nice middle-class mother, right? But and thank God I wasn't plagued and haven't been plagued with alcohol and drug abuse. But I remember taking my fourth grader to school, and one of the mothers had a horrible alcohol problem, horrible. But her parental rights weren't terminated, and she could get in little skirmishes with the law, but her parental rights weren't terminated. You know, she drove a nice car, and we went to nice school, and we had nice after-school activities. So I want to, and we have people who are absent from their kids for a long period of time because of their own doing. But their parental rights aren't terminated. So I'm not saying these parental rights shouldn't be terminated. I just want to make sure they're terminated for the right reason and that there's no implication of any denial of their statutory or constitutional rights. So, and it seems to me fundamentally unfair to set up conditions for return if they are absolutely impossible to meet. So let's go through these conditions.
May I address a couple of things in your discussion?
My diatribe.
First of all, your friend did not have her child in foster care, I imagine.
Okay.
And second of all, we need to focus on this child and the needs of this child and every child in terms of making decisions regarding what's best for a particular child.
Fair enough. And focusing on this case, was drug and alcohol counseling available for her in the institution?
It was, and she had not yet started it.
Was that her choice?
I don't know. The record does not contain information regarding that. And standing before you as an officer of the court, I don't know the answer to that question.
Is there usually a long waiting list for those programs?
There are, on occasion, waiting lists for different programs. But I want you to remember that Jody W. sought to be released early on a number of occasions. And ultimately, the decision of the criminal court judge from Fond du Lac, I believe, denied her attempts to be released early.
Counsel, if I could, it sounds like you're suggesting that the judge took into consideration a number of different items here, not just the passage of time. And if that is your position, I note that opposing counsel has argued that we should be looking at the Nevada decision of In Re JLN and how the statute was applied in Nevada and do something similar here in terms of not just looking at the passage of time in isolation, but looking at the entire circumstance. Would you disagree with that approach?
Absolutely, because the Nevada statute was purely a 15 out of 22 ground. And what I mean by that is there was no other proof that needed to be proven, no other evidence that needed to be presented to prove that ground. It was simply, was the child placed outside the home for 15 out of 22 months? If you proved that, you were done. There was a rebuttable presumption that it was in the child's best interest to terminate parental rights. And then the parent would be under an obligation to rebut that presumption that it was in the child's best interest. We don't have that situation in Wisconsin, gratefully. There is no TPR ground that is based solely on the 15 out of 22 months. We have individualized termination of parental rights grounds that have been harmonized by the Adoptions and Safe Families Act. And the JLN case was not a constitutional case. The decision of the appellate court in that circumstance is that the trial court abused its discretion in finding that the parental fault prong was satisfied. So that Nevada case, JLN, doesn't even apply at all. Now, by analogy, Jody W. Says, look at the Champagne case, because JLN relies in part on the Champagne case, and that's 100 Nevada 640, the 1987 case. For her proposition that you can't be held unfit for failing to meet an impossible condition of return. Look at that case carefully. The Nevada court considered four TPR cases at once. And what happened in that circumstance was that a parent was found unfit for failing to parent the child. Well, that case is most analogous to our Wisconsin abandonment statute. And the reason I say that is in that Champaign case, I believe it's the Felsen part of that Champaign case, the parent could not provide for the daily care of that child because the court order prohibited her from parenting the child on a daily basis. And the reason I say that it is analogous to the Wisconsin abandonment statute is because a termination of parental rights action cannot be commenced alleging that a parent has failed to visit with the child when there is a court order in the CHIPS case prohibiting visits. And so in terms of the cases cited by counsel in support of this constitutional issue, they don't apply at all. And I say gratefully, because we don't have a purely 15 out of 22 month situation. Counsel for Jody W. cited an Illinois case, the HG case, and that TPR action was commenced on two grounds. One, a purely 15 out of 22 month ground, and the other in a similar to Wisconsin continuing CHIPS ground. Well, that similar to Wisconsin continuing CHIPS ground was never appealed in the HG case. What was found to be unconstitutional was that purely 15 out of 22 month.
Here's the problem I'm having with your argument, counsel. You're arguing the 15 out of 22, but as I read the statute in question, it's 6 plus the likelihood of 12. So it's 18. Am I missing something? When you look under sub 2A3, that the child has been outside the home for a cumulative total period of 6 months or longer pursuant to such orders, and that the parent has failed to meet the conditions for the safe return, and there is a substantial likelihood that the parent will not meet the conditions within a 12-month period. So it's 6 plus 12. How is that much different than the 15 out of 22?
How it's different is that there is more to prove in Wisconsin than purely the 15 out of 22. As I indicated before, the only proof that had to be, the only evidence that had to be given to prove that was merely the child outside the home for 15 out of 22. In Illinois, the TPR statute, the 15 out of 22 one, was based purely on the passage of time. And then it shifted the burden of proof to prove that it was not in the child's best interest to terminate parental rights in the dispositional section. And that's not where it belongs either. The finding of unfitness needs to be made in the grounds phase. And while certainly at the time of the disposition, other evidence, including an argument on a parent's part, that while it's true I was incarcerated and am incarcerated, I will be getting out of jail next month. And so while I can't meet the 12-month, the substantial likelihood I won't meet the conditions in the next 12 months, potentially at the time of the disposition under the statute under 48.427, the court can consider other evidence. And that other evidence in conjunction with the standards and factors under 48.426 include the relationship between the child and the parent. Is this child 15 versus 2?
Counsel, I'm still back at the statute. It's the same one that Justice Butler is talking about, sub 3, that is 48.415 2A3. You've got the 6 months. The child's been outside the home. And conditions that are set that have not been met, and a likelihood that they will not be met within 12 months. That's, as I see, the breakdown of that 3A.
That's one of the elements of the continuing CHIPS ground, yes.
what's the other element of the
First of all, you have to prove that the department made a reasonable effort to provide the services ordered by the court. So in addition to being placed outside the home and continue to be placed outside the home, you have to prove that conditions of return were entered so that there were certain things that the parents had to do in order to have the child safely return to that parent's home.
Sure.
It's hard to get a question in here. The court decides against you. And let's say we say, well, as applied, it is unconstitutional. What effect? Now, we have a child who is going to be 6 years old. The mother's been out of his life. How long would it take for Jody to comply? Let's say she did the things you wanted her to do. What is our time span here? How long is it going to take? Assuming she does
it. That's a decision of the Honorable Circuit Court.
So you can't, but would it be fair to say that at least in the drug and alcohol and some of the other considerations, she could succeed or she could fail? Is that? And if she fails, then what happens to the child?
Then we would have to file another termination of parental rights action, and that
now
continues to be
now the child is there for now. The child is 6, 7, 8 years old, and what I think bothers me here is that if we quote individualize this, that the gist of the statute, when you look at the best interest, I understand the due process argument, but this is sort of a hit and miss situation. And you understand that if the court, because as we apply this, if you lose, what effect is this going to have on how you operate with people that are incarcerated?
It's going to have a huge impact upon how we operate in terms of if we have parents who are incarcerated and have long-term sentences, it will impact that issue in terms of.
Can you even provide these services if they are incarcerated?
Well, the department is charged with making a reasonable effort to provide the services ordered by the court, and although not directly before the court here, one jury indicated to our social services in a decision coming down 10-2 that our social services should have sent someone to the state of Florida, entered the Florida prison system, and provided psychological treatment to that parent who was incarcerated in the state of Florida because it was not available to that parent.
Counselor, that answers to the question that I tried to raise a minute ago. One of the parts of the grounds of continuing CHIPS is proof that the county shouldered its responsibility. And I want to know if you can tell me what things did the county do to help Jody meet the conditions that were set?
Well, first of all, that issue is not directly before you to the extent that Jody W. does not raise that as an issue. She is not challenging that the department failed to make a reasonable effort to provide the services ordered by the court. But in terms of answering your question, they provided visitation services that were monitored and supervised by an agent of social services in terms of dealing with the parent-child interaction and providing feedback to Jody W. regarding the fact that you should not give a child candy and then go play tag with this particular child, should not allow a child to be left unsupervised while you go and leave the room. And so to the extent that social services through a contract agent, Project Home, provided visitation and parenting assistance. In addition, the social workers contacted the institution, indicated to the institution the types of services that the mother was court ordered to provide, and certainly provided assistance to the mother in the form of permitting her and assisting her in contacting her own child.
So they didn't really do anything then in regard to helping her get suitable housing, right?
Well, they couldn't really assist in a reasonable way to assist her in obtaining housing for a house that would not be necessary for more than 2 years from now. At the time the CHIPS petition was initiated, it was November of 2002, and we believed, and it turns out to be true, that Jody W. would remain in custody from November of 2002, when our action began, until March of 2006. It doesn't appear to be reasonable, nor does Jody W. allege that it was somehow unreasonable, not to assist the parent in obtaining housing that, at the time of the termination, in the fall of 2005, still would not be needed for another 18 months.
After the petition was filed, did the county seek a court order trying to see if there was an avenue by which Jody's counseling requirements could be met, perhaps ahead of the DOC schedule? Did you do anything to try to further her ability to get the counseling requirements that the CHIPS order required?
What's in the record is that the social workers contacted the institution and indicated the necessity of the individual therapy and the domestic violence therapy.
That's really all that's in the record.
I don't know that there's anything else in the record.
And I'm not sure the court would order DOC to do anything either, because that's generally not the approach they take. They let DOC run their own, you know, timing within the institution. Thank you. I was just curious.
I believe my time is up.
Yes, counsel, if you don't get unfitness under subsection 2, is there any other grounds that you can fit her in?
In other words, has she failed to visit or communicate with her child such that she may have abandoned her child?
Yeah, that's right.
I cannot say that she has abandoned her child, because social services was bringing her child to her, and there was a period of time in which the court prohibited her from visiting with her child. And so
there was no parental disability as defined. There was no continuing denial of physical placement as defined. There was no failure to assume parental responsibility as defined. No incestuous parenthood as defined. No homicide or solicitation. Commit homicide as defined. Parenthood is not a result, as far as we know, of sexual assault. So if you don't get her under 2, you can't terminate.
Well, we did not file under the failure to assume parental responsibility ground. Although I would indicate to you that I do not concede that that ground does not exist.
You'd have to show she never had a substantial parental relationship.
I understand what that ground is. We did not file our TPR petition, but I am not conceding that that ground does not exist.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Voiland.
I want to start with Justice Wilcox's questions about the other conditions of return. And on that, I'll make one point first. There is nothing in the record about domestic violence, and I'll make that again. I made it in my last brief. On AODA, I'll turn to the appendix at 0179.
Okay. This is on alcohol.
And this is where the court talks about the other conditions of return and whether they've been met, and the court finds that there's not sufficient evidence to know beyond conjecture that they haven't been. That's line 6 through line 10. I mean, there was a question also to the Kenosha DA about whether or not she chose not to go into AODA or whether or not it just wasn't available to her. I believe you asked that, Justice Rosenthal. And the court says, we don't know whether her own free will would be that choice. There's nothing in the record to say that she did that, did or did not. The second point that I want to go to is this idea that we are not challenging the reasonable efforts of the department. We are. I'll point you to page 23 on my opening brief, point you to my reply brief at page 9. And as far as what the department did, as far as what the record reflects the department did to provide services to her, is the record reflects that the department, quote, encouraged her to meet her conditions of return. And if we're looking at the department's statutory obligations, it is not only that the department must provide reasonable efforts, it's that the department must provide a reasonable and conscientious effort in encouraging a parent to do something that is impossible. I don't know that that's conscientious. I want also to go into the record on whether or not there was evidence before the court at the grounds phase of the efforts made by the department, because I don't believe there was. I will first point to the record at page 81. That's where initially the plea was entered as to grounds. And I'll only stay there for a second, because there were two hearings. The court held a grounds hearing on September 20th, 2004. Because of the plea, the court did not take any testimony, as it was required to do by Wisconsin Statute 48.422. The next time the parties went into the circuit court was October 22nd, 2004, a month later. This was for disposition. And I apologize, I'm flipping from page to page, but at page 106, the court says, and I want line 17 at 106, this matter comes on for disposition. At which time, Ms. Hart says, the court asks Ms. Hart if she's ready to proceed, the court says, Ms. Hart says, not to disposition. And the court says, well, why? She says, well, 48.422 requires the court to take evidence in support of the allegations in the petition. And the court says, no, I already made a finding of unfitness. Last month, I made a finding of unfitness. And Ms. Hart says, no testimony was taken. The court says, well, didn't you stipulate to the CHIPS file? The court then goes on from there. And it takes some evidence, but the court is taking that evidence at disposition, not grounds. And the court goes on from there, page 119, and says, the court asks, here's my question. We have a stipulated no contest plea to the grounds. Are we getting into this subject for the disposition phase, or are we on the grounds portion? She says, well, we're going to use it for both, so the court is conflating grounds and disposition. The court says, the grounds were stipulated to. I don't intend to entertain argument. The court is not listening to any of that testimony at the disposition phase. It is only taking it at the grounds. And the court again confirms. It says, I don't have any problem if we're taking it for disposition. That's lines 10 to 11. Court then goes on, curiously, when it makes its finding, and this goes to your question, Justice Wilcox, about whether or not the court considered all of those other factors, whether or not the court considered her drug conviction, her incarceration, and everything else in ruling on grounds. And here's the court's finding on grounds. This is page 122. The court does find that there are sufficient grounds for failure to meet the conditions of return, that the department did make reasonable efforts to meet those conditions, and they were not met. And here's how. The child has been out of the home for 5 months or longer. The warnings were given, and it's not likely that the grounds would be met in the future in the 12 months following. The court therefore finds the mother, as to the mother, that the grounds have been unfit. So at that time, the court finds only the passage of time are the grounds. Then the court, and I suspect, Justice Wilcox, this is part of the record you're pointing to, and as the question of, has the court been looking at those other things? Then the court at page 179 of the appendix does say, much later on, at this point in the proceedings, we don't look any longer at what is best for Miss, or what is best for the department, or any of those things. The whole focus of this portion of the proceeding hearing is what is best for Max. So the court earlier looked only at the time, and it did not look at those other factors until it got to disposition. And doing that is contrary to the statutes, and it's contrary to the court's case law.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Boyland, and thank you, Ms. Hart, for your arguments today in yet another TPR case to come to this court. I would like to, on behalf of the court, thank Mr. Boyland. He appears here on a pro bono basis because Jody W. was not represented by counsel, and we appreciate your taking time and effort to prepare the briefs and for oral argument. Thank you. And that concludes our March arguments, and that in 05AP0002, NM Kenosha County Department of Human Services versus Jody W. We are adjourned. The court will meet in closed conference at 3:15. Mr. Boyland, I see you had a little help from Louis Balin and Rebecca Freihart. They are to be thanked also. We are adjourned.